You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
And I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Thursday, August 25th, 2011. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the Majority Report. We are broadcasting live in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City, future home of Hurricane Irene. Today on the program, John Amato from the Uber blog, Crooks and Liars. Also, happy belated anniversary for the Lewis Powell memo, what has brought you just about everything horrible in our politics today. More news on not just the tar sands Keystone protests, but also the State Department's imminent ruling on the viability of that project. Also, a shout-out to Florida. Thank you. Thank you, Governor Rick Scott. Upgrade on Northeast trains. Care of Florida. I will explain as the show continues. Also today, we will have our first installment of the Mitt Romney flip-flop moment. We only need a couple of seconds for that one, fortunately. Highlights on the next congressional battle that will cost us jobs and defund important programs. But first off, you probably heard the news. Steve Jobs sitting down, stepping down, presumably because of illness. From the CEO of ship of Apple computers. I don't know if we'll see anything in the near run, the implications of that, but it is a pretty amazing story. But here's something that caught my eye. I'm not going to spend too much time on it, but here's one thing that caught my eye that I did not know about Steve Jobs. I don't know much about him. Anil Dash, from his blog, had an interesting take on this. And he reminds us that a single company has gone from just being 90 days away from bankruptcy at one point to becoming, and not just, you know, Chapter 11. I think it was like Chapter 7. They were going to shut the doors on this place. And it has come down, it has become what he calls the unequivocal leader in innovation, design, branding, and now valuation. And the transformation happened in less than a decade and a half. He says, most interestingly, there's a unanimous consensus from fans and detractors alike, both within and outside the company, that a single man bears the lion's share of the credit for the vision, leadership, and execution that's made this achievement possible. Who is this man? Well, of course, he's talking about Steve Jobs. But this I did not know. He's the anchor baby of an activist Arab Muslim who came to the U.S. on a student visa and had a child out of wedlock.
Wow.
I had no idea he was an anchor baby.
Huh.
He's a non-Christian, arugula-eating, drug-using follower of an unabashedly old-fashioned liberal teachings from hippies and folk music stars of the 1960s. And he believes in science, in things that science can demonstrate, like climate change and pi having a value more specific than 3, and in extending responsible benefits to his employees while encouraging his company to lead by being environmentally responsible. Here I would put a caveat in the sense that there are some things that are I think Apple does, that, you know, slave labor in China. It's not slave labor. It's child labor. And pushing for a tax repatriation, I think, right? I mean, are they part of that, or is that just Microsoft? Every single person who'd attack Steve Jobs on any of these grounds is demonstrably worse at business than Jobs. They're unqualified to assert that liberal values are bad for business when the demonstrable, factual, obvious evidence contradicts those assertions. Just something to chew on today. And now I want to talk about this story. We've broken format today. We're going to have John Amato on later in the program. This story I pulled yesterday. It came out at 6 a.m. from the AP. I've been waiting to see if anybody would provide some analysis for this story, have them on. It, as far as I've seen, nobody has covered this story. The AP does a blockbuster report that, as far as I can tell, it would appear there are numerous violations of federal statutes here. And nobody has covered it so far. Part of it could be it's a weird time to drop a story like this on Wednesday. It's also a weird time to do it in the slowest news time. Everybody's on vacation. And, or, I mean, for those people who have jobs, they're on vacation. And hopefully next week I was planning to go to the beach. I don't think that's going to happen. But I will be back live probably on Thursday. I'm going to be live tomorrow from my cave. But we will effort somebody to give us some analysis about the potential legal implications of this story. It's a big one, folks. And like I say, it's provided by the AP. It started to unravel in June of 2009, 2 years ago. Apparently, a superintendent went into an apartment in New Brunswick, New Jersey, and saw what he thought was basically like the apartment of a terrorist cell. He saw terrorist literature on a table, computer, surveillance equipment, all of this stuff. He freaked out. He called the FBI. They went into the building, the FBI did, and what they found was not an apartment of a terrorist cell, but a surveillance post in New Brunswick, New Jersey, of the New York Police Department. Now, for those of you who are not from the Northeast, New Jersey is not New York City. For those of you who come into the city, or I remember growing up as a kid, whenever you met anybody who said, I'm from New York City, if you asked them where, they would say New Jersey. If someone was from New York City, they would say, I'm from the city. Because they didn't realize that, like, well, there are other cities in America. If they said they were from New York City, you could be sure they were from New Jersey.
That's true. I can verify that.
So, apparently, since September 11, 2001, the New York Police Department has become one of the country's most aggressive domestic intelligence agencies. The AP did this blockbuster report, and it found that the New York Police Department operates way outside of New York City. It targets ethnic communities. Try and guess which ones. I can assure you, it's not Crown Heights. And it does so in a way that would clearly run afoul of civil liberties laws if practiced by the federal government. I still think there are numerous statutes here that have been broken. But here's the real kicker. It does so with unprecedented help from the CIA. Now, remember, as I go through this story, the CIA is legally prohibited from doing any domestic spying. None. That is a purview for the FBI. And there's a specific reason for that, because it's pretty problematic. The CIA works with far less oversight than any other agency in the country, except short of, I think, apparently, the New York City Police Department. The City Council of New York City, which finances the police department, has no idea what's going on. The police department, I guess, sends out what they call rakers into minority neighborhoods, and they do this human mapping program. We'll get into this as we go on, but apparently what they do is they go around and they just take record of all little, you know, bodegas run by Pakistanis, cab stops. This is where this person hangs out. This is where that person hangs out. A veteran CIA officer, while still on the CIA's payroll, was the architect of this program. And this program is ongoing. As of last month, a CIA agent on the payroll of the CIA has been working inside New York City Police Headquarters. Apparently, any information that has been derived from this program has been kept out of the courts because they're afraid of how the courts are going to react to this. Huh, I wonder why. It starts, apparently, back in January of 2002. There was a former CIA agent, David Cohen, who was hired to head up the police department's intelligence unit. He basically went back to the CIA, still had friends. Maybe it was a reunion party. Asked the CIA for help. George Tenet sent a guy named Larry Sanchez, who had served as a CIA official inside the United Nations, to go to the New York Police Department and set up a bunch of different programs. Now, there are times where CIA agents, apparently, are lent to other agencies, but they are no longer paid by the CIA because it's against the law for the CIA to spy on Americans inside this country. Tenet kept this guy on the CIA payroll. There has never, at least to our knowledge, ever been an arrangement like this one. And apparently there was some controversy within the CIA as to Tenet sending this guy and keeping him on the CIA payroll. Now, as this guy Cohen, who headed up this intelligence unit, developed his vision for a unit within the New York Police Department that essentially had the same powers as the CIA, one tiny problem existed. Since 1985, the New York Police Department had operated under a federal court order which limited the tactics they could use to gather intelligence. Because apparently, and I think it's well known, during the 1960s and 70s, the New York Police Department had sort of gone hog wild in trying to track down domestic terrorists like, members of the Weather Underground or and presumably going beyond just terrorists to people who were just politically dissenting at the time. So to settle a lawsuit at that time, the police department set up very specific guidelines that required very specific information that there was some type of criminal activity taking place before they could in any way monitor political activity in New York City. Apparently in 2002, this guy Cohen told a federal judge that that's too restrictive. We can't find terrorist plots if we can't go after people who are involved in just, you know, political activity. So Charles Haight, who was a U.S. district judge, basically said we're going to have to throw out those guidelines. It's a new day dawning. And you guys can just do basically whatever you want. And apparently, one of these units, called the Demographic Unit, which profiles people. I mean, it's a unit built to profile, had never been exposed before this AP report. What they do is they are mapping these ethnic neighborhoods. And it is probably very close to the line, if not well over it, in terms of crossing the line about federal statutes about ethnic profiling. In 2007, the LA Police Department tried to implement a program like this human mapping. And William Bratton, who was the chief of police at the time, scrapped it because people said, you can't do this. And he said, a lot of the people that we're mapping here, Bratton said, a lot of these people came from countries where the police were terrorists. We don't do that here. We don't want to spread that fear. So the lesson, apparently, that New York officials learned from this was you don't tell anybody. You keep it completely secret. And the police, apparently, have been regularly shredding any of these documents that even mention these police rakers. So when Cohen went to this federal judge, however, he said, we promise to abide by the FBI's investigative guidelines. We will actually apply certain guidelines. They won't be the ones that were imposed on the city because of the abuses that took place in the 60s and 70s. We'll follow the FBI guidelines. However, that said, the FBI is not allowed to have undercover agents unless there's specific evidence of criminal conduct. And the police department apparently has not held any of those guidelines. Of course, the police department, when asked about this, said, "Oh no, we're not breaking any civil, we're not breaking any civil rights." Now, how do we know that? Where have we seen some of the clues of the existence of this? Apparently, there is a lawsuit that was filed on behalf of anti-war groups back in 2004 who were protesting the Republican National Convention. And these undercover officers were involved in infiltrating these groups. When protesters were arrested and penned in on that on Chelsea Piers over here, they were asked questions like, what are your political affiliations? Do you do any kind of political work? Do you hate George W. Bush? Christopher Dunn, a New York Civil Liberties Union lawyer involved in the convention lawsuit, said, at the end of the day, it's pure and simple rogue domestic surveillance operation. Detectives have used informants known as moss crawlers to monitor weekly sermons and report what was said. Several current and former officials directly involved in the program have said, if FBI agents were to do that, they would be in violation of the Privacy Act, which prohibits the federal government from collecting intelligence on purely First Amendment activities. The FBI, and any time they have done this, have been required some evidence of a crime before an informant can be used inside of a mosque. The FBI cannot troll mosques just looking around, seeing what's going on. And that is why senior FBI officials, according to this AP story in New York, ordered their own agents not to accept any reports from the NYPD mosque crawlers. You see how the FBI, not only has the FBI been shut out of this, but to the extent that they had access to any of this information, they don't want any of it because it is complete. This is the same thing that the FBI did when it came to Abu Ghraib. Apparently, the intelligence division for the NYPD has asked the taxi commission to run a report on all city Pakistani cab drivers. Does that sound like profiling to you?
Wow.
That strategy has been outright rejected in other cities. The Boston police chief wants to ask Cambridge to do the same thing. The Cambridge police chief said, no effing way. So this guy Cohen, his undercover squad, the Special Services Unit, has operated in such places like New Jersey, which, like I say, is different from New York City, Pennsylvania, Massachusetts. And those are just places where the cops, apparently, when they were surveilling people, got pulled over by other cops and said, what are you doing? The NYPD apparently also inserted their spies into the UN and brushed up against the FBI there. The AP has agreed not to disclose details of either the FBI or NYPD operations at the UN because they involve foreign counterintelligence. So this guy Sanchez, who was on the FBI payroll, his assignment in New York ended in 2004, but he ended up leaving the CIA or taking a leave to become Cohen's deputy. He ended up resigning retiring last year, and is now a consultant in the Middle East. However, this program is ongoing. Last month, the CIA sent one of its most experienced operatives, a former station chief in two Middle East countries, to work out of police headquarters as Cohen's special assistant while still being on the CIA payroll. The department's primary watchdog, the New York City Council, has not held a single hearing on the intelligence division's operations, and council members typically do not ask for details. The New York City Police Intelligence Unit last year had a $62 million budget, which has never been audited by the city comptroller's office. In 2003, the Justice Department ruled, put out detailed rules against racial profiling, including prohibiting agencies from considering race when making traffic stops or assigning patrols. I wonder if getting dossiers on every Pakistani cab driver falls into racial profiling. Those rules only apply to the federal government, however. And so it's unclear as to whether or not there is a specific statute for the cops. I imagine there is. And I imagine you're going to be hearing more about this story as we go forward. We're going to hold off on a break for a minute because there's another story I want to talk about. And folks, I don't know why this has not gotten more dissemination. But chalk one up for the majority report. Now you know. 33 cents a day. I will remain, I'll bite my lip about being crass about joining this, becoming a member and maintaining this on. Now, of course, you could have read this piece, and I imagine hopefully some of them did, but it is massive. It really is a massive story, and I think, I don't know why they didn't put it out in five different segments, to be honest with you, because it's a big story. I just got a couple of minutes here, and I want to talk about this because Wednesday, what's today, the 25th?
Yeah.
On Tuesday, there was an anniversary, a very sad anniversary, I should say, of the authoring of a memo I have here in my hand. Confidential Memorandum, Attack of American Free Enterprise System. To Eugene B. Snyder, Chairman, Education Committee of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. Now, back in 1971, when this memo was written, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was like that old-fashioned idea of the Chamber of Commerce. Hey, Mr. Crabtree, We should have a celebration of the town's businesses to help drive business to downtown. Well, okay, I'm going to bring this up at the next meeting of the town chamber of commerce, and we'll all get together and help the businesses out so that we can have a thriving downtown area. Well, that's the way the U.S. Chamber of Commerce was back in the day. But this guy, Lewis Powell, who at the time was an attorney from Richmond, Virginia, wrote this memo. He was writing about what he perceived an attack on business. He said it was an attack on the American free enterprise system. Now, this is a guy who is a board member of Philip Morris and other companies. And he wrote this memo. It's massive. We've linked to it on Majority FM, as we will the NYPD story. He wrote this massive memo with the premise that the attack on corporate America was not just coming from the dirty hippies, not, as he wrote, from few extremists of the left, but also, and most alarmingly, from, quote, perfectly respectable elements of society, including leading intellectuals, the media, and politicians. Remember, this is a time where you had the greatest expansion of the middle class in the history of this country, and their economic security was giving them the confidence to act in the political arena. And so you had people coming out for civil rights, for anti-war measures, for increased pensions and health, women's rights, basically the whole spectrum of human rights for African Americans to get a vote, for women to get equal pay, for the environment in particular. Remember this date, 1973. This is just a year or two after Nixon, yes, Richard Nixon, signed the Environmental Policy Act in January of 1970. It was followed up within a year or so with the creation of the Environmental Protection Agency. Prior to 1970, there was no laws about pollution. The Clean Air Act was instituted in December 1970. In April 1971, there was the first air pollution standards. Suddenly, you weren't allowed to dump crap into the water if you were a corporation. You couldn't use lead paint because it was making kids who were exposed to this lead. It was creating birth defects. It was hurting their mental capacities. Raised the awareness of like pesticides and other pollutants. DDT was banned in 1972. So you've got businesses saying like, holy crap, our ability to offload the expense of using these products onto the public, we're not going to be able to do that anymore. You understand the dynamic here, right? They don't include in the cost of their production of things, things like cleanup. That expense is borne by all of us, in the form of asthma, brain malfunction, birth defects, death. And he wrote, since business executives have little stomach for hard-nosed contest with their critics and little skill in effective intellectual and philosophical debate, in other words, politics, it was important to create new think tanks, legal foundations, front groups, and other organizations. Quote, careful long-range planning and implementation and consistency of action over an indefinite period of years in the scale of financing available only through joint effort and in the political power available only through united action and united organizations. This memo did not become publicly available until after Richard Nixon appointed Powell to the Supreme Court of the United States. After the report was unleashed, a task force of 40 business executives reviewed Powell's memo and drafted a list of specific proposals to, quote, improve understanding of businesses and the private enterprise system. This was adopted in 1973 in November. Powell's memo is according to a piece written by Charlie Cray from Greenpeace, and we'll link to this, is widely credited for having helped catalyze a new business activist movement with numerous conservative family and corporate foundations. The Coors, the Olin, Bradley, Scaife, Koch, and others. Everything that we have talked about on this program for 7 years, starting with the original majority report. This is, I'm going to name off some outfits that were developed in the short year and a half, 2 years following this memo. The Business Roundtable, 1972. The American Legislative Exchange Council, ALEC, 1973. The Heritage Foundation, 1973. The Cato Institute, 1977. The Manhattan Institute, 1978. Citizens for a Sound Economy, 1984. You know them now as Americans for Prosperity. The Powell memo, folks. If you want to know what the conservative movement has been doing for the past 40 years now, read the Powell memo and you will find out. We're going to take a break. When we come back, John Amato from Crooks and Liars. We'll be right back after this. We are back. Sam Cedar on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a tremendous pleasure to welcome back to this program the founder, proprietor, the visionary behind Crooks and Liars, crooksandliars.com. You all know this website. It's where you get everything that you want to see, not just analysis of news stories, but also all the great video clips. John Amato, welcome to the program.
Hey, Big Sam, what's happening?
Not much. The rain is starting to fall here. We are expecting the imminent arrival of Hurricane Irene. And
dude, is God mad at you? I mean, first he hit you, you know, with an earthquake, and now you're getting a hurricane. Sounds to me like certain people are blaming a certain type of groove for causing this heavenly response.
Let's not dance around this. I mean, we all knew this would happen once we allowed gay marriage in this state. Here it is, hurricanes, earthquakes. The one good thing is Yankees losing to the Red Sox.
Well, we shall see. But yes, I've been saying this all year, that the Yankees will not win in the playoffs. So I agree with you. I think it'll be the Red Sox against the Phillies. So I actually may have to become a Philly fan in the World Series.
Yeah, you say that without the proper sadness in your voice, and so I resent that. That's the problem with the Yankees fans. They just go, "Oh, it doesn't matter. We'll win next year."
No, it does matter. Are you kidding me?
We've won.
It matters. It's a killer. You think I want to like watch the Phillies against the Red Sox? Absolutely not.
Well, I promise.
Brian Cashman is stubborn and wants to make a point. Plus, he's on his last year of his contract. And there's never been a Yankee team that spends this kind of money, you know, since '96 that refuses to even help their bench or get a reliever some piece to at least help the roster at all. He did nothing during the trade deadline.
God, it's so easy to set you off. I enjoy it.
I know you wanted to get me going, and that's one thing.
All right, look, I want to talk about two things with you because you had a great post the other day putting together a lot of writing that's been happening about the retirement of the Social Security age. We are on the cusp. The super committee is already doing their work, busy as beavers, getting ready to screw the middle class. We know that the cost of raising Medicare's eligibility age would end up costing double what we spend now on Medicare, and it'll end up being borne by everybody who has insurance programs and, you know, frankly, elderly people who can least afford it. But let's talk about why raising the Social Security age. Why shouldn't we? People are living to 120. By the time we raise the Social Security age, people will be living to 120 years old. That's what. What's that guy's face? Jonathan Alter told me at one point.
Oh yes, good old Jonathan Alter. He's supposed to be a lefty, right?
Mm-hmm.
Part of the problem is liberal elites, just like Jonathan Alter. But that's a whole other category of problems we have. And the facts of the matter are. Is that the people that are living longer in this country are the rich and are the very wealthy, and people that are not, it's actually been very flat since all these programs came into play, which means that the population itself isn't suddenly found the fountain of youth because of increased benefits in unemployment and in Medicare and Medicaid and in you know, easier work and technology. Average, your 98%ers are not living longer, their lives are not immeasurably better, but suddenly we're supposed to raise our retirement age as part of this shared sacrifice. And you know, do they expect, does Alter know maybe that there's some new, you know, pharmaceutical breakthrough that's going to suddenly make us live till 120?
Well, I mean, maybe there is, but of course, those people that live in the bottom half of the income distribution, they won't have the money to afford it. There's a wonderful graph that's been going around that shows that even if you go back, I mean, I think this graph goes back to 1970, if I remember correctly. But the fact is that even since like the 20s and the 30s, if you measure from the age of 65, the extension in life expectancy for the bottom half of the income distribution has been minimal, maybe 14, maybe 18 months. The top half has grown fairly rapidly, 7, 8, 9 years, I think. But that's because, and you know, I think you hit it on the head. The reason why we don't see this data, except from dirty effing hippies like yourself. I know you're sitting there in a tie-dye smoking a hookah as we talk, so good for you to be able to maintain this conversation.
Actually, I have my Charles Mingus t-shirt on this morning.
is because the people who are writing about this, the people who command the discourse, they're the people who live longer.
Absolutely. I mean, the point's been made over and over again where because of a decline in the economy, but that our journalistic community and journalism in general has been hit just as hard as many other sectors. And it's the punditry class, or as we call them, the Gang of 500, the Beltway Media, the Villagers. They're the ones who open up their shows and just promote this idea as if raising the age from 65 to 67, well, you know, is easy. It's like, you know what I mean? There's no effect to that. It doesn't affect people's lives. It's just like, well, you know what? We have to, you know, just raise, you know, touch the sacred cow. Why is it a sacred cow? Well, if you look at the data, it'll tell you why it's a sacred cow, because people aren't living longer. And when you're 65 years old, your body's breaking down if you're in the 98%ers, and you're probably working much harder jobs that demand much more manual labor, which takes a greater toll on your body. Whereas the Beltway Media class and these people that go on TV to say it's no big deal, let's just raise the age, what are they doing? They're talking for a living. They're writing for a living. Disease, you know, doesn't discriminate, but that in the vast populations, the toll on the working class is much harder on their bodies. And it's quite, you know, and I don't mince words in these posts. It's cruel, it's horrific, and it's frightening that time after time and show after show that we put on, the news media will not even report those facts. How many reports have we heard that have said that only the rich and wealthy are experiencing this boom in life growth expectancy?
And, you know, on top of that, the other sort of, I guess, sad paradox here is that you're not going to be saving that much money because the bottom half of the income distribution, they don't live that much longer after 65.
Exactly.
And so you will not actually be saving that much money, but you will be making those last couple of years for those people genuinely miserable.
You know, like I've talked about it, in history is such an important part of politics, and we hear so little about, you know, why FDR did what he did, you know, why the New Deal came out, why Harry Truman said some of the things he said, why Eisenhower said some of the things, because they actually saw the population underneath them. They saw what was happening to people, and they were horrified to see senior citizens dying in the streets of the United States of America, literally, you know, living off the streets, and it horrified them, and it didn't matter what party they were in. And that's why, you know, I believe it was 1946, was it, where the first waves of health insurance for all was being bantered around, because the to actually see the population that you preside over being tortured like that can change a person, and it's changed many a politician's mind. But if you listen to Marco Rubio, what he said, you know, was that, you know, we're becoming soft, and that, you know, churches and synagogues would actually, you know, would step up and take up this cause, right? And let's face it, in the 30s, in the 40s, in the 50s, this country was much more married to the Christian church and to just in church, you know, organizations generally. And I don't, you know, they didn't do it back then, and they ain't going to do it today. But the fact is, and it's not to say that there are a lot of great and kind people in all these communities today, but that nobody has the resources.
That's right. And we just got a couple minutes here, so I just switch topics here, just because, on this version of our show, we don't talk too much about what's going on at Fox, but I still enjoy watching clips on your site. And I saw this one, and I really enjoyed it. It was 6 minutes long, so we can't play all of it, but it just set this up, the one with Bill O'Reilly and Trapper John and
right.
and well, the teacher right. from Ferris Bueller.
Yeah, right. Well, really quick, you know, O'Reilly, who basically has been passing on the talking points for sort of the uber grand poobas of the Republican Party, and he sets the tone, and that's why he was for raising the debt ceiling, and that's why he wanted TARP. But we can get into that. So he's been saying basically that the entire deficit is all Obama's fault, and it's the fault of liberal policies. Okay, the entire $14 trillion is all liberals' fault. And then, obviously, after Warren Buffett came out and said, listen, we have to stop coddling the super rich, O'Reilly's been attacking him and basically saying, look, he can just give his own money to the federal government. And he's been saying that he's crazy and that raising more taxes on rich people will hurt job creators. And then in his following segment, he had Jack Trapper John and Ben Stein on to discuss it. And they are regulars, if your listeners don't know it. They are regulars on Fox News on Saturdays and also on the Fox Business Channel. And I'm sure your audience knows a lot of the wacky things that Ben Stein has said. So it was quite shocking to me. Do you have a cue of this?
Yeah, let's play this. Ben Stein, former Nixon advisor and speechwriter, I think, and supposed economist, guy who has some weird set of beliefs, including, you know, the fact that the Earth is only 6,000 years old. But He gets it right on this one. Let's listen to this.
If you take, then you're helping the recession. You're feeding the flames.
That's not true.
Sure it is.
That isn't true. I mean, there's no correlation. I'm going to call you Mr. O'Reilly. There's no correlation, Mr. O'Reilly, between tax rates on millionaires and people above that level, billionaires, and the growth of the economy.
We've had what do you think business people are? Business people are going to find that they're going to take less money?
No. We had the highest growth in capital and in productivity and in the economy generally in the 40s, 50s, and 60s when we had much higher taxes than we had now. Higher taxes
have historically been correlated
with more growth.
All right. Okay.
This is also probably what happens with gay marriage. We have hurricanes, we have earthquakes, and Ben Stein and I agree.
We also have terrorist attacks, right? Just as I said, we have September 11 coming on, and it was Jerry Falwell and Pat Robertson who also blamed the gays for the 9/11 attacks.
That's a great clip. I had two clips pulled out of there, but we don't have time to play them. But people should go check that out because it's definitely worth watching. Riley can't get these guys to agree with him on anything.
No, and he tries, you know, what makes him exceptional, what he does is that once you start disagreeing with his premise, he immediately interrupts you with a different sort of take on the issue to throw you off, you know, what you were talking about. And it actually, since Stein is such a regular there, he was kind of unflappable. It really shocked me, and that's why I wrote about it and got the clip up, because Stein makes the case, actually, that in the best growth days that we had in this country, those were the strongest times of unions in this country, of workers' rights and people organizing and people getting a fair deal from corporations. And those were the golden years. You know, that's what Michael Moore laments in his capitalism music movie, how when he was growing up, his father worked in Detroit and was able to support his family, mm-hmm. just by working the one job because the job workers and the companies had a mutual deal that allowed that to happen. Well, now we fast forward 60 years and that's not the case, where overall unionization is down from what, 35% to 7%.
7% in the public sector, yeah.
Right. It was a truly remarkable thing for Ben Stein to say, only because for most of the time when Stein's on Fox News, he's always complaining about taxes and cutting taxes. But the idea that taxing the rich will stop them from, you know, creating jobs is ludicrous. It has nothing to do with it. You know, what we've seen over these past Bush years is that millionaires and billionaires, they're fighting over, you know, before it would be, which mansion they would buy.
Right.
Well, now it's which Italian villa they'll buy. And so it does not hurt their living situation or the way they live one iota. What it does is, okay, instead of having 15 Lamborghinis and 12 Ferraris, they'll have only 7 Lamborghinis and 3 Ferraris and 15.
I don't even think it's that. I think it's just that we're, instead of having 15 Lamborghinis and having a ton of money to invest and get 15% capital gains tax on it, I'm just going to have less money to invest. That's not going to create any jobs anyways, because my hedge fund participation doesn't help anybody except for the guy pushing the paper. But
exactly.
John Amato, Crooks and Liars, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks, brother.
All right, folks, we are out of time. Now we head to the better half of the show. We're going to have that flip-flop minute in the better half of the show, as well as an update on Keystone. And that thank you, my big hug and kiss for Florida, for helping us out with all the new train upgrades. And give you that update on Verizon, the union strike, all in the better half of the show. Folks, if you can become a member and join us in the better half of the show, please do. Would you like to have your media? Well, I'll save that for tomorrow because I get a question about it. But become a member at Majority FM. Please, we need your support desperately, honestly, desperately. And you can always support the show by buying a junk through our Amazon link. You can support the show by buying coffee from Just Coffee at justcoffee.coop. Use the coupon code MAJORITY.
Donate your account. Leave us an iTunes review on iTunes.
DonateYourAccount.com/MajorityFM. You can get that Marin bonus interview. If you you just email us or tweet us, tell us that you've donated your Facebook account. We'll give that to you. And please, give us some ratings on iTunes. That's the least you could do. All right, see you in the better half.